Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Al-Qaeda and bin Laden never imagined that the 3,000 people who lost their lives that day would inspire 3 million to put on the uniform and harden the resolve of 300 million Americans. They never imagined the sleeping giant they were about to awaken.
Vice President Joe Biden at the 9/11 ceremony at the Pentagon yesterday, invoking the resolve of Americans joining the military. We will begin our program today asking, what did we remember to say yesterday, and what did we forget? And we'll see if any lingering unity from the 10th anniversary might spill over into the new debate over the president's jobs bill. Who knows? WNYC political reporter Bob Henley and WNYC's Andrea Bernstein, who directs our Transportation Nation blog, are both with us. Good morning.
Good morning. Good morning.
And listeners, what did we remember to say, and what did we forget yesterday? We being anybody who spoke publicly. 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. And Andrea, you were covering politics here for most of this past decade. What were you thinking yesterday, seeing the return of many of those Pauls from that era to Ground Zero? Governor Pataki, Mayor Giuliani, President Bush.
Well, it certainly brought me back to that moment. And it, you know, it did make me reflect on the difference between this political era and the political era then. In 2001, I mean, one of the, you know, reasons for this sort of outpouring of love for especially Giuliani at the time, but almost everybody sort of, you know, got some of the warmth was that people sort of, you know, really wanted to have this sense of political stability. And in fact, the year after 9/11, the first memorial, 2002, there was an actual effect that was tracked where incumbents who lived in the area around 9/11, around Ground Zero, were more popular than anywhere else in the country because there was this incredible desire for political stability.
Incumbents, so that would include Congressman Gerald Nadler, who represents the area in the House, the mayor at the time, Giuliani, the governor at the time, Pataki?
Well, what happened with, you know, it was Giuliani was term limited out, but it did hugely affect the politics of the city because Giuliani endorsed Bloomberg. And on 9/11, that was the Democratic mayoral primary. And at that time, I believe Michael Bloomberg was about 25 points behind. So when we woke up that day to cover the election, we were convinced that the next mayor of New York City was going to be selected among the Democratic
right.
field. That didn't happen in large part because of the sort of transference of blessing from Giuliani to Michael Bloomberg.
Right. So if Mark Green was seen as an incumbent, that incumbency popularity didn't transfer to him. But Bob Henley, there was that moment yesterday where there was a little surge of applause for President Bush when he got up to do his reading. And he did a very neutral kind of reading, Abraham Lincoln, the Bixby letter to the mother of five sons
five, right.
in the Civil War. But and not to say it was a majority of the families at the site, but he was the only politician for whom at least a few people, and I couldn't tell from the audio how many, wanted to go, yeah.
It was odd because President Obama, to his credit, had picked Psalm 46, which was certainly nonpartisan. and so to have I thought it was kind of a dissonance when I heard that applause, actually. I thought to myself, this is kind of odd. Because I think Mayor Bloomberg had established an important tone. And I think that Obama, President Obama, followed with that Psalm 46. And then to have, of course, the reading that Bush selected was totally appropriate. I think the thing that was missing for me from the conversation to pick up on Vice President Biden's comments, yes, we woke up a sleeping giant, perhaps, but this is a sleeping giant who is deeply in debt and still ensnared in overt wars in Afghanistan and Iraq and covert operations in several other countries. And so much of our current economic problems can be traced back to that. And I also found it just a tad bit narcissistic, a kind of blind spot that we didn't refer at all to the tens of thousands of civilians around the world who have lost their lives as part of a prosecution of the never-ending war on terrorism. Not that we don't need to, of course, be mindful of our loss, but this has been a very hard decade on the world.
Except that, you know, you know, the sort of 9/11 families. I mean, I remember being out in 2004 with President George W. Bush out on Long Island at also memorial services talking about 9/11. And this is a group of people, some of them, who felt extremely attached to him. And I remember talking to one of the widows at that time and saying, "What is it about George W. Bush that you love?" And she said, "You know, he's just kept us safe." So there's a sort of emotion to it that I don't think sort of, you know, is calling on reason, but there's a sense of sort of, you know, the doctor that saved your life. There's a sort of comparison that you know, that was sort of imprinted, and it's very hard to dispel something like that, despite what happens historically afterwards.
You know, Bob, you said you were interested in things that went unsaid in the formal ceremonies yesterday. You also said that President Obama, to his credit, read from Psalm 46. But I was curious about that. I mean, it was officially supposed to be secular. Here is 30 seconds of what President Obama chose to read on this officially secular occasion.
God is our refuge and strength, a very present help in trouble. Therefore, we will not fear, even though the earth be removed, and though the mountains be carried into the midst of the sea, though its waters roar and be troubled, though the mountains shake with its swelling. There is a river whose stream shall make glad the city of God.
So,
who said it was supposed to be secular, by the way? Because Mayor Bloomberg set down the framework?
Well, wasn't there a controversy that was resolved in favor of not having clergy there and having a secular tone to it?
Well,
you were reporting on it.
Well, I'm wondering, though. I mean, I don't think there was a referendum held. And I think the president, to his credit coming into this, was picking something that was bigger than himself. And he was not going to put his own words to the moment. And looking around the crowd, there was a solemnity and a spirituality that I felt, at least where I watched people listen to what he had to say.
I also wonder who wouldn't want to hear those words. I mean, those words were balm, you know, especially when you think about everything that has sort of happened politically, physically, you know, tornadoes, hurricanes, earthquakes. Right. So this sense of instability and sort of, you know, kind of rising above seems to, you know, sort of be the essence of, you know, what somebody addressing this, you know, occasion beyond words.
And neither of you political reporters want to assign any political meaning to this, rebuilding his image a little with swing state America, or maybe with the religious voters in tomorrow's special election to replace Anthony Weiner, nothing?
No, I don't. I think that when you're speaking after walking in that shining pool and feeling the gravity of that loss, I think even a hardened politician might transcend the moment.
Let's try another one. It was supposed to be a non-political affair, too, but listen to the reading that Governor Cuomo chose.
The first is freedom of speech and expression everywhere in the world. The second is the freedom of every person to worship God in his or her own way, everywhere in the world. The third is freedom from want, everywhere in the world. The fourth is freedom from fear, anywhere in the world.
Governor Cuomo reading from FDR's Four Freedoms speech, which really, Andrea, is a call for activist government, isn't it?
Yes. And I mean, I do think that it sort of has a special sort of 9/11 resonance that is pointed, especially the freedom of expression when so much has been said and written about what's happened in the last decade, freedom from want, freedom from fear. On the other hand, I still think that, you know, Roosevelt is a fairly safe political figure. I mean, obviously, he was a politician, he was president, but there's a sense in which he sort of transcends and that he led this country through a great moment of crisis. So Cuomo, by the way, I mean, a sort of interesting historical footnote to all of this is he got into such trouble when he first ran for governor in 2002. This was the year he was running against Pataki, when he accused Pataki of holding Giuliani's coat. And it was a terrible, I mean, it really backfired
against
him.
Meaning he was just playing bland second fiddle to the mayor.
Right. And it really sort of, exactly. And it really backfired against him because of that sense at the time of sort of, you know, we, our political leaders are sort of, you know, people that we like. So different than, you know, what's happening now where Congress is at its lowest approval rating ever. And, you know, Obama, we'll see what happens this week. But it's been a very tough summer for him.
I mean, I think also that what was helpful here is that in there was the aspirational aspects of America, the affirming transcendent U.S. values that evolves us from this kind of simple narrative that was important, the war on terrorism, to stay alive because they hate our freedoms. We have grown. That 10 years of pain and suffering, both globally and locally, have caused some reflection. And so I saw in remarks that President Obama made last night a hint at kind of turning the page. So what does this new world look like that's redeemed on this 10 years of sacrifice? And so I think to some degree it's hopeful.
In fact, we have that clip. Let's flip ahead to Obama talking about the future of peace.
Our troops have been to lands unknown to many Americans a decade ago, to Kandahar and Kabul, to Mosul and Basra. But our strength is not measured in our ability to stay in these places. It comes from our commitment to leave those lands to free people and sovereign states, and our desire to move from a decade of war to a future of peace.
Is that what you were thinking?
Exactly.
Of?
I mean, I think there is a kind of idea, and it's very important to set the table, if you will, for what's coming next, which is the UN General Assembly. One of the things that has happened to the good on the upside in the world is the fact that from Egypt to Tunisia, the cry in the street is no longer jihad, but give me a job. We have a whole generation of the Arab street that is coming into its own, wants their nations back, and you saw the fall of Mubarak. To a large degree, Mubarak's existence was part of the petri dish that gave rise to the Muslim Brotherhood and Al-Qaeda. Now that that's fallen away, can America be a handmaiden to this rebirth of potentiality?
Right. And you thought, and I thought yesterday, that the reverence for fallen heroes was defined too narrowly, certainly to honor the police officers and firefighters who were killed on that day, certainly, but much less mention of the heroes who died of disease after working on the pile years later, those who went off to war and got killed in Afghanistan and Iraq, and even the many thousands of civilians in those countries who've gotten caught in the crossfire.
And also the tremendous effort within Iraq and Afghanistan by our allies there who die. You know, we lose contact with this, but dozens, hundreds killed, and, you know, we kind of lose that disconnect. And I would hope that if 9/11 does anything, it gives us a new global literacy. Because quite frankly, I think that we had a blind spot on September 11th through which those planes flew. So the best deterrence is to have a kind of global engagement that is more just by being aware of what's going on around us.
All right. On what wasn't said yesterday, let's hear from a couple of callers. We had an interesting caller to our special coverage yesterday morning. This was Eleanor calling in.
I'm finding so much here, a passive voice. Somebody said to read the names of the members we lost. Well, we didn't lose members. They were murdered, actually. And the lady just now spoke about the hole which was made. It's as if these were like spontaneous, you know, eruptions that happened instead of by naming these attackers, and I'm wondering why it's like an unspoken, you know, agreement. We're not going to say who did it.
Eleanor, with me and Leanne Hansen in our special coverage yesterday. John in the West Village, you're on WNYC. You want to talk about something that you think was unsaid?
Well, something that was said. I was particularly intrigued to listen to family members who, after naming the names of their relatives that they had lost on the podiums on stage left and stage right, then would add in 5 or 8 seconds of, oh, and I miss you and I will see you in heaven and what have you. There was one gentleman of Italian descent or Spanish descent. He had a heavy accent, and he was the one person to say very pointedly, and let us remember that this is not a man-made disaster. I think in referring to there have been recent hurricanes and tornadoes lately, he said, this is not a man-made disaster. And there was the beginnings of anger in his voice, which I love to hear from a relative.
What do you think he meant by not a man-made disaster? It's the exact opposite of Eleanor's point, which is to say, don't forget, these were murders.
He was the one person who said, let us remember that we are here and we have been attacked. It was the one moment of acid, which was actually very welcome. And if I recall, maybe I was just seeing it, over his shoulder was one of these very solid state troopers who had a slight, just satisfied nod of, yes, thank you, sir.
Just so I'm clear on what you're really saying, that it was a man-made disaster, that this was caused by people.
Well, he was saying that this was something that was correct. It was man-made. In other words,
a natural disaster.
Correct.
Right.
Correct. And there was this first quality of someone reading the name of a relative, which said, let us remember my relative has been murdered, in other words. So it wasn't all passive. And he also briefly said, because now we have to live in this sort of secure state. It was 8 or 10 seconds, which conveyed a lot. And for a non-public speaker who's been waiting a year and deciding what to say, I thought it was very important. I'm going to have to go back and see what it is on C-SPAN, but it was very good.
Thank you very much. Fran in Westchester may want to make an opposite point about what was left unsaid, yes?
Yes, I want to say that we have to learn that we cannot cure the ills of violence by creating more violence. And if we want to be a beacon of light for the rest of the world in some way, we can lead by really doing some aggressive focusing on how to solve problems with peace instead of violence. I know that Obama, mentioned the word peace, but it's all just rhetoric, and I think he's in a position to reignite the feelings that we had right after September 11th, to join the world together and to fix problems without violence.
Thank you very much. We have a few minutes left. Andrea Bernstein, put on your Transportation Nation hat, because now Washington moves on to the president's jobs bill with a lot of transportation infrastructure in it. The speech was Thursday night. The formal legislation gets sent up to the Hill this week. What are you waiting to see from a New York area standpoint or a transportation infrastructure standpoint?
Well, I don't think that this particular jobs bill, even if it's passed exactly as the president wanted, would create a huge amount of new transportation infrastructure activity, although one of the things that he did talk about in his speech was next-gen air technology. Which is something that there is a center in New Jersey working on that.
Air technology?
It's basically to sort of improve the air traffic flight control systems to make more effective, to make the skies more efficient, if you will. But I think what is fascinating about this is if you sort of follow the trajectory of this discussion in the last year, I mean, a year ago we were talking about Governor Christie and his concerns about spending on the ARC tunnel, which led to his eventual killing of that project. But a couple of interesting things have happened in August. First of all, Governor Christie, using similar language to the language that he used when he wanted to pull the plug on the ARC tunnel, but on the other side, said that the Port Authority tolls had to be raised because you couldn't just, at this moment in history, stop all these construction jobs.
By the way, President Obama is going to officially introduce the legislation and send it up to the Hill today. And in about 15 minutes at 10:40, he's going to do a brief appearance in the Rose Garden, and we will carry it live on our politics website, itsafreecountry.org. So my last question is, do you see the politics of unity from yesterday, either of you, having any lingering effect, since it was such a stark contrast to the polarization that's holding up economic policy?
I do think that this is a moment. I think one of the things he needs to follow up on is to ask for U.S. Attorney General Eric Holder to actually ask for the Supreme Court to take up his Affordable Health Care Act on an expedited basis right away, because he's had mixed reviews. The 11th Circuit ruled it unconstitutional. He had some positive rulings in the 4th. This would do a lot to send the signal. He understands the anxiety small, mid-sized businesses have. They just don't know how to plan. I've even spoken to Democratic hospital administrators who want it resolved. I think that would be a real great way to get some clarity up front.
Andrew, 15 seconds.
I'm not sure if it's a 9/11 inspired moment of unity, or it is the Congress members looking at their own polls and seeing they're actually worse than the president's. But I would say that in the last couple of weeks, and particularly in reaction to the job speech, we have not seen the slash burn. No, 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 no. There is a sense, I think, in both parties in Washington that if there's no joint action, the collateral damage inflicted on the whole institution becomes too much for anybody to sustain.
Republicans may be unpopular in some of their swing districts right now, but we also see in Brooklyn and Queens that special election tomorrow to replace Anthony Weiner, in which the Republican Bob Turner is having some success because the polls are very close, closer than you would think. He had a slight lead in the last poll that came out last week in the middle of New York City by making Obama an issue.
Right. I think also, remember, though, even when he ran against the talented incumbent Weiner, he got like something like 40% and he had a fraction of his money. So that district has always had a kind of conservative Democratic blue dog streak.
And we'll talk to the Democratic candidate David Weprin coming up in about 10 minutes. WNYC's Bob Henley, WNYC's Andrea Bernstein, editor of our Transportation Nation blog. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Yes, David Weprin still to come. Also, there's a really new, interesting new map from the website DNA Info about crime neighborhood by neighborhood in New York City. And some of these comparisons are really interesting. Do you think the South Bronx, say Mott Haven, might come out better than Brooklyn Heights in any of these categories? Maybe.